Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Hello, my friends. Welcome back to our Through the Bible podcast. This is Josh Swanson, lead pastor at Christ Church in Sierra Madre. So today we are going to be jumping into the books of 1st and 2nd Kings. It's a little bit of a misnomer to say books in plural because in the original, I mean, this was actually one book. It couldn't fit on the length of one ancient scroll, and so it was divided into two parts. Thus, we have 1st and 2nd Kings. This is the story of Israel's royal history. It's the monarchy. And it covers roughly 400 years from 960 BC to 586 BC, and it is concerned with the policies and actions and destinies of the kings of Israel and Judah. And I think for a lot of us, you know, kings and queens seem kind of removed from our everyday life as Americans, unless, of course, we're talking about the kind of kings we do like, you know, Michael Jackson, you know, the king of pop, or Elvis, the king, you know, or of course, King James, you know, good old LeBron. And is LeBron really the king, or was Kobe the king? Is Kobe, or was it Michael Jordan? And I'm impartial to Kobe Bryant myself, and I get it if others have differing opinions, and you have every right to be wrong. There's something about, the work ethic, you know, the passion, the attitude, you know, of Kobe that's just, you know, compelling, you know. But, so we're not overly concerned, I think, with kings and queens. In fact, of course, we live in a nation that was established to get away from kings and royal abuse. And I think one of the marks of a postmodern age is extreme skepticism and suspicion of those who hold power, because what are they going to do with that power? They're going to take advantage of us. They're going to abuse their power. And why are they doing that? I think they're really doing that because they just want to hold on to their power. And I can find myself, you know, kind of going into a very suspicious mode when I even think about our own politicians. I think they're just in it for the fame or the celebrity or the money or the power. And of course, our political offices, especially the highest office in the land, President of the United States, is associated with all those things, celebrity and power and money. And so we can think, you know, are they really doing this because they want to serve the people, or do they got a secret interest in mind? And what's interesting, I think what's actually so relevant about Israel's royal history is that this book, Kings, is as suspicious as we are about kings. This is not the kind of history that is told as propaganda. You know, oftentimes we tell history from the vantage point of, let's only focus on the good and the glorious, and we use it in order to heighten our reverence for our nation or for our founding fathers or for our leaders and this sort of thing. American history, of course, like just about every other nation, has told its history in this way to further solidify, you know, our own self-perception of being the greatest nation on the earth, and American exceptionalism, and all the rest, you know. And but Israel, interestingly, doesn't tell its history this way. Here, these books that cover 400 years of its history, and it's actually incredibly critical of its leaders. There are some, I think, 40 or so kings that are listed in this collection, and almost all of them get a bad report card. And so it's a very, I think, satisfying, I think, read in some ways, because it's so honest and it's critical in its evaluation of its leaders. Now, I want to do today is just kind of give a basic introduction to this, to the book of Kings. And I want us to note four things about the book of Kings. And the first is the most obvious, and that the book of Kings is about Israel's kings. In fact, we could be even more specific and particular than that. Israel was divided because there was a civil war described in 1 Kings chapter 11, 12-ish. There's a civil war between the northern half of Israel, the northern tribes. There's 10 tribes in the north and then 2 tribes in the south, even as our own nation had a civil war. But the outcome of their civil war was different than ours because they ended up dividing and becoming 2 different, you know, separate governments. And the northern kingdom, there's a long succession of kings described here, and then it also describes a succession of kings. Did I say succession? That's a hard word for me to say right now, but you get what I'm talking about, don't you? You're like, Josh, I get it. I understand. You know, it's hard sometimes to pronounce those lengthy multi-syllable words. But anyway, it's about Israel's kings, and so it's royal history. But I think what's interesting is, although it's royal history and it's about the kings, it's not purely a history as we might think of it, because there's almost nothing, you know, given about the different rules, the different governments that were led, the different administrations of these different kings that we might ordinarily want to know. You know, you crack open an American history book, and you read about, you know, President McKinley. Like, there was even a president. Like, who even knows about that guy, right? William McKinley? I mean, what would it be like to have been the president of the United States? And, I mean, honestly, you were like, was that one of our presidents? And even right now, as I'm saying this, I'm questioning myself, like, maybe we didn't have a McKinley. No, I think we did. But you open up the history books and you can read about the different presidents and their administrations. And what do you learn? Well, you learn about what was the economy like, what was the geopolitical situation, did people like them? What were their policies? What was happening? And who was in their cabinet and so on. You know, Kings doesn't give us any of that about the different kings. In fact, you'll take a leader like Asa. It tells us he was on the throne for a couple decades. And what does it tell us about him? Well, almost nothing. We don't know about the economy. We don't know about the size of his military. We don't know whether or not he had good relationships with the surrounding neighbors. And instead, what this gives us is a succession of report cards, like grades of the different kings based solely on their relationship to God. And so the primal interest of this author is, how did this king relate to the God of Israel, the creator of all things? Were they loyal to God, or did they forsake him by worshiping idols and then leading the people in worshiping idols? And so as you read through the book, you're like, is there any more information? And it's not disinterested history. It has an agenda, and the agenda is to tell the story of the kings from the vantage point of how did they relate to God. And I think it's worthwhile for us, you know, modern people, as we read about this way of doing and telling history, to think in our own day about, you know, how do those who hold power in our world relate to the God who made them? Because ultimately, all of us have some modicum of power. You know, your words have power. Sometimes your silence has power. You know who you are. You know, sometimes your biting remarks, sometimes your coldness. And if, of course, if you're a parent, you've got power. If you're a teacher in a classroom, you have power. If you are a manager in an organization, you have power. There's all sorts of ways in which we wield power. If you're a police officer, of course, obvious power. A politician, obvious power. And the question is how are we exercising our power? And do we do so with a mind that we are accountable to God for our use of power? And what the Book of Kings puts us on notice of is, at the end of the day, all leaders, and the kings of Israel especially, are held to account to the God of Israel for whether or not they are leading the people in fidelity to God and to his ways, and specifically his way of ordering a just society that reflects a desire for the good of the neighbor and the centrality of worshiping God and of excising from the land idols and idolatrous places. And so, number one, this is a history of the kings, but it's not a disinterested history. It's a history with an agenda, and it's an agenda and it about how the king relates to the God of Israel. Now, one more note on this first point. My first point is that the book of Kings is about kings, the most obvious of points. But let me just say a word about where this sits in the larger unfolding story of the Bible. Because what you got to know is that the Bible is one unfolding narrative. And it's very interesting. You know, I've read some of the Quran. I've read, a good chunk of the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine of Covenants, you know, these other texts that are held by other religious communities. And the Bhagavad Gita, I've read some of that. And I think what's unique and very distinct about the Bible is the Bible has one single unfolding storyline. Now, it's not a neat, clean story. It's got a lot of disjunctive, you know, places and ups and downs and curves in the road and wide detours, but there's one unfolding story. And as we said multiple times, the key moment in the story is the formation of the people of Israel. And so the Bible, or especially the Old Testament, is the story of the creation of the nation. God loads the nation of Israel down with his blessings. And through this nation, God wants to bring his blessing to all of the families of the earth. And so part of what it means to receive the blessing of God is to have his land. And so the people are promised land, the promised land. And they're given his law, the Torah. And they're given his presence, the temple, and the palpable presence of God, and the priesthood and sacrificial system. And so as the story unfolds, it's this story of God building Israel into this great nation that's loaded down with his promises and with his law, his way of being in the world, his way of ordering society, his personal presence, and his land, and also the kingship. He gives kings. And so, you know, first Abraham's called, the nation grows, they go into slavery in Egypt, God liberates them, he takes them to Sinai, he gives them his law, they wander in the wilderness for a bit, ultimately he brings them into the land, that's the book of Joshua. In the land, they drive out some of the inhabitants, but still they are beset by their enemies. Then God raises up judges to lead them. Judges don't turn out to be a good model for leadership, so then God establishes a king over his people. And the first king, of course, was Saul. That's a bad king. But then they get David, who's the true king. And then what the book of Kings tells us is now the succession of administrations, the succession of leaders, first beginning with the line of David. And every administration, every king in the southern kingdom of Judah and Benjamin down in the south, the southern kingdom, remember there was a civil war, those are governed by one of the sons of David. In the northern kingdom, there are some, you know, 10 different dynasties, but southern kingdom, only one dynasty. But so that's essentially what the book of Kings is about. It's about how the story of the Bible is being carried forward now. And we'll more on that later. So number one, the book of Kings is about the kings. Number two, the book of Kings is not only about kings, it is also about the holy city, Jerusalem, its people, its leaders, and especially the temple that sits in the heart of the city. So check this out. The Kings has a bookend. It opens in 1 Kings 5-8 with the construction of the temple. Remember, David wanted to build God a temple. God said, "You're not going to build me a house. I'm going to build you a house." And God says, "Thank you for your offer, David, but I don't need you to build me a house. I'm good." You know, It's kind of funny. God's like, they're like, let me give you this. And God's like, yeah, thanks. I'm good. You know, you don't need to do that, but I'm going to build you a house. And then he says, but I will allow your son Solomon to build me a house. And sure enough, Kings opens and David's in his final years. And then Solomon takes the throne. There's some, you know, friction, you know, in the transfer of kingdom, as it often was the case in the ancient world. And are you tracking with all of this, by the way? How are we doing? You know, so, but here's the point. Solomon builds the temple in chapters 5 to 8. And then after this lengthy description of the gathering of all the materials, the generosity of the people, the skill of the workers, the temple's done. And the people gather and they celebrate. And it says that the glory of God filled the temple, and his presence was so palpable and thick that the people fell on their face and they cried out, "He is good, he is good, and his steadfast love endures forever." Which is, that's a great way to be like, so Solomon, king, all is well. Jerusalem is the capital. The temple is there. The presence of God is flooding the place. Solomon grows the kingdom, and Israel is at its very zenith. It is at its wealthiest, most powerful, most influential moment from a geopolitical standpoint. And so this is the opener of the book of Kings. It begins with the building of the temple, right? And then at the very end of 2 Kings, it concludes also with the temple. Only now, this is not about the building of the temple. It's about the sacking of the holy city, Jerusalem, and the destruction of the temple, and the departure of the presence of God, and God's people that were in their land now going off into exile. And so this book is framed as a tragic history of how Israel went from a really good beginning under Solomon, and how through its idolatry and how its infidelity to Yahweh, the nation ultimately splits into civil war and then ultimately will end in exile. They're out of their land. Their temple is destroyed because of their infidelity to the law, and the monarchy seems to be lost. And so it's a tragic way to end. And friends, this is how the Old Testament story ends. Like, there were all these promises and hopes. It begins good. And then and then they're like, what's going to happen next? How's the story going to carry forward? And of course, the prophets come on the scene, and we'll get to this later, and they start promising, oh, a day is coming where a shoot will spring forth from the stump of Jesse. You know, his line was cut off, it seemed. His great-great-great-great-grandson Jehoiakim was taken into exile, and he's languishing there in prison, eyes gouged out in sadness and pain and chains and exile. And it says a shoot will grow out from the stump of Jesse. One will come from the lineage of Jesse, and God will establish a king once again. And so, but going back, so the second point, the book of Kings is not just about kings, it's also about the city, and more particularly the temple that occupies center place in the city, its construction, and then ultimately its destruction. It's about the descent of the presence of God, and then it's about the glory of God leaving the temple. And it's the story of this long succession of unfaithful kings that take the nation on this tragic journey from presence and temple to destruction and departure of the presence of God. And so I guess you could say it's kind of, you could read it from that vantage point as an invigorating read, you know, although honestly, it doesn't feel like an invigorating read. We'll get to where I think it gets quite exciting, but some of it's kind of a slog and you got to kind of read through it. And I don't know if you've ever read one of these big old, like massive novels, like I remember attempting to read The Brothers Karamazov, and there's so many names, you know, when you're reading it and you're like, wait, whose brother is this? Who's this guy? And you got to kind of write the names down to keep track of it. And I think a good practice when you're going through Kings just is to write down who are the kings, each king in the northern kingdom, and who are the kings in the southern kingdom. So Number three, it's not just about kings, and it's not just about the temple and the holy city, Jerusalem. Kings is also about the importance of the Torah and faithfulness to the Torah, that is God's law in the life of Israel and in the life of the kings. And the significance of Torah is stated not any more clear than it comes from the lips of David in his admonition to his son Solomon at the very beginning of you know, Solomon's reign, or when David is charging Solomon just before Solomon takes the throne. And it goes like this. Listen to what David says to Solomon. He says this: I am about to go the way of all the earth. Solomon, I'm about ready to die. Be strong and show yourself a man. That's good. Be strong, show yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God. This is the responsibility he's going to carry as a king. Keep God's commandments. Keep charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways, keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, and his testimony, as is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn, that the Lord may establish his word that he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons pay close attention to their way, to walk in me before faithfulness in their heart, with all of their soul, you shall not lack a man to sit on the throne of Israel. And the importance you see as you read through the rest of Kings, the importance of the kings walking in the way of God's is not just for the kings. It's because as go the leader, so goes the people. And this is just often true, right? Like, you look at a toxic organization, and oftentimes, you know, you can draw a line up to the leader of the organization. He's or she's been toxic, abusive, or whatever, and it just creates an environment. As go the leader, so goes the people. I remember being charged as a pastor by a mentor. He said, look, leaders go first. You want to see your people serve? You serve. You want a congregation that prays? Leader, you pray. You want a congregation that loves the Bible? Leader, you love the Bible. Leaders go first, because as the leader, so often the people go. And so you see this throughout the succession of kings. God calls the leaders to task because of their infidelity to the law of God and how they lead the people into infidelity to the law of God. And you know, so the kings by and large are judged primarily based upon how faithful they were to Yahweh and to his law. And I think one of the interesting things is as you read through, you'll notice that 80% of the content or the attention in the book of Kings is devoted to the kings in the northern kingdom, so the top 10 tribes. Only 20% is devoted to the southern kingdom, which is kind of interesting because the southern kingdom carries David's line. You would think they'd be more interested in that kingdom, but actually no, they're more interested in the northern kingdom. And both the northern and southern kingdom get conquered. The northern kingdom gets conquered first by the Assyrians. So they come in and they defeat the northern tribes and then take them into exile. And then the southern kingdom, a few decades later, gets conquered by the Babylonian Empire, who succeeded the Assyrian Empire as the dominant, you know, force in the world. But the cause, the presenting cause for exile and for their defeat of their enemies, is that they have been unfaithful to the law of God. And you remember back in Deuteronomy, this is what God promised. This is what he said would happen. I told you this would happen. You know, you are unfaithful to my law. You know, and so the kings are deeply concerned with the law of God. And that's why one of the most exciting kings, and you got to keep plowing through Kings till you get to 2 Kings chapter 22. This is far along in the reign of the southern kingdom, just toward the end. There's this high moment of revival. So for decades, they had been unfaithful to the law of God under the reigns of Manasseh and Amon, and then Josiah comes on the scene. Josiah, It's a cool name, you know, like Josiah. And Josiah was only 8 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. And listen to what it says about Josiah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and walked in all the way of David, his father, and did not turn aside to the right or to the left. And get this, in the 18th year of King Josiah, the king, Shaphan, the son of Azaliah, son of Meshullam, the secretary, you're like, who's someone say, oh yeah, the son of Meshullam, the secretary to the house of the Lord, he said, go up to Hilkiah, the high priest, that he may count the money that has been brought into the house of the Lord, which the keepers of the threshold have collected. Let them go down into the hand of the women, the workmen who have oversighted the house of the Lord, and give it to the workmen who are at the house of the Lord and start repairing the house. And so he's like, look, you know, the church is in disrepair. You know, it's an old sanctuary. The rest of the properties, like, let's go and do I'm just coming on the heel of a renovation project. And so Josiah is like, my man, he leads them in a renovation project. They renovate the temple and they're so excited about it. But in their quest and in their renovations of the temple, they discover that some things had been forgotten that should have never been forgotten. Something had been lost that should have never been lost, namely the sacred copies of the Torah, of the law of God. So the kings and the people had been without their sacred text, their sacred revelation from God at Sinai for generations now. And then get this, Hilkiah, the high priest, finds that which had been missing for years. And he says this, I have found the book of the law of the Lord in the house of the Lord. And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan and read it. And Shaphan, the secretary, came to the king and reported it to the king. He said, your servants have emptied out the money that was found in the house and have delivered it into the hand of the workmen who have oversight in the house of the Lord. And then Shaphan, the secretary, told the king, Hilkiah, the priest, has given me a book. And Shaphan read it before the king. And when the king heard the book of the law, get this, he starts hearing the Bible being read and he tore his clothes. You're like, why did he tore? Like, I've never been sitting in church and just tore my clothes. You know, that was a sign of mourning and grief and repentance. Why? Because he realized, it was like a mirror. He was like being shown, and he didn't realize it was all over his face until he looked in the mirror. He's like, oh my gosh, I need to get cleaned up. And he reads the ways in which the people have been unfaithful. He knows what's coming, judgment. And so he tears his clothes and he says, go inquire of the Lord for me and for the people. He says, go pray for us concerning the words of the book that have been found. For great is the wrath of the Lord that is kindled against us because our fathers have not obeyed the words of this book to do according to all that is written in this law concerning us. And so as the story unfolds, Josiah leads the people in all of these reforms and he implements the law of God in their society so that now the good ways of God are ordering how they are running the neighborhood, how they are living in the neighborhood, how they're caring for people. It's governed by God's law. Their worship now is being governed by their celebration of the holidays. They're becoming the people of God once again underneath the leadership of King Josiah. Sadly, this is really like a blip on the map. Or is that the right blip on the map? Was it a saying? You know, in Israelites' histories, because after this, the people go right back down to their old ways, and ultimately they are led into defeat in an exile. But you see with Josiah the importance of God's law and the connection between God's law and their fidelity or their infidelity to God's law and how they were experiencing and whether or not they could hold on to life in the land, and it turns out they can't. And so number one, Kings is about kings. Number two, Kings is about the holy city, Jerusalem. Number three, the book of Kings is about Torah. It's about law. But fourthly and finally, the book of Kings is not just about kings. It's also about prophets. it's interesting, you know, in the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the Jews often refer to this as the latter prophets. First and Second Kings is part of the latter prophets, which for me, I always thought it was confusing because I think about the prophets being, you know, Isaiah, Jeremiah, you know, Daniel, Malachi, so on and so forth. And you think about First and Second Kings being about history. But actually, in these books, there is space given to prophets, some pivotal prophets, namely Elijah and Elisha, who break in unannounced, uninvited, and who call out God's people and who speak truth to power to those kings. And with the emergence of these prophets, specifically Elijah, and you've just got to read, you know, 1 Kings 17, it begins, his story begins in it. These stories are engaging. Elijah is like, you know, you're reading political history. And quite frankly, you know, 1 and 2 Kings, there's so much of it that reads like, yeah, this is how it was done in ancient, you know, in the ancient world. You know, one king gets into power and they go around and they kill every one of their rivals and the families of their rivals. Nobody's left breathing, and only so there's no threats to power. And then there's intrigue, and then somebody sneaks in and they try to usurp the throne and get the affection and the love of the people. And then there's civil wars, and it's what you're reading in first. In some ways, there's nothing uniquely supernatural about it. It feels just like political, like ugly, violent political history and humans vying for power. But then breaking right into this history, it feels like this closed system, this closed universe of just an unfolding succession of violent king after violent, vying for power, holding on to power. And we are sitting there cynical, suspicious, going, yeah, I know it. You know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. So just look at this. And then breaking in unannounced and uninvited are these prophets. And with the arrival of Elijah, we come to this abrupt and a decisive interruption in the royal narrative. And we see and we witness a counterforce in Israel's life. It looked like the most important power at work was the power of the kings and their ability to wield their power and hold on to power and get elected and get campaign contributions and all the things. But we learn there's a counter force that is stronger. There is a strange and better and truer power that breaks in. It's the power of God through the life of these prophets. And it's almost impossible to overstate the historical, the literary, the theological significance of this intrusion that features Elijah and Micaiah and Elisha. The three are completely unexpected. They're uncredentialed. Nobody invited them in to royal history. And yet here they are, and they enact and they embody the raw, unfiltered power of Yahweh to bring life and to speak truth and to challenge the tyrants and to call God's people to fidelity. And so you see this power at work. And there's all kinds of just unusual, interesting things that happen through the life of these prophets. You know, fire is called down from heaven. There's oil becomes a bottomless, you know, source of provision for a destitute widow. You know, a precious borrowed axe head that sunk in the Jordan floats to the surface. You know, Elijah does not die, but ascends in a chariot of fire to the heavens. And, you know, in the actual miracle count, Elisha somewhat surpasses Elijah. But, you know, Elijah is just, he's a monster of a prophet. He's just, you know, and here it is, I think, speaking this truth to us. And I think this is a word from the Book of Kings to us. Who are suspicious and cynical of those who wield power. There's an affirmation of that cynicism in some ways, but it's a challenge to only give in to our cynicism and our suspicion and to say, actually, there is cause for hope. There is cause to actually challenge some of the ways people wield power in our world. And there is a better, truer power at work. And in this case, it's in the power of Elijah. But Elijah, of course, becomes just he's the biggest miracle worker. He and Elisha are the biggest miracle workers in the Old Testament. More so than Moses, certainly more so than David. David doesn't do miracles. You know, there's not a lot of miracles in the Old Testament. You know, I mean, there's some parting the Red Sea, of course. You know, let's not forget that. But, you know, they're rare and they are unusual and they're out of the ordinary and spectacular. And but the closest you get to what we see in Jesus, the healing miracles, the type of stuff Jesus is doing, it are these uncredentialed prophets, Elijah and Elisha. And they become the forerunner to the true and better unfiltered raw power of Yahweh to heal and to bring life and to save and to speak truth to power that breaks into the world into Jesus, who announces to us that his power is the power of the kingdom of God breaking into the midst of the kingdoms of this world. That ultimately this story that looked like it ended in tragedy, ultimately, you know, it looked like there's a catastrophe at the end, you know, exile and destruction. But there is what J.R.R. Tolkien called a U-catastrophe, a good catastrophe, a turning of the catastrophe into a dramatic change and turnaround for the better. It looked like all hope was lost, but then there was a turn. And the turn breaks into the world and Jesus of Nazareth, who comes bringing God's power to bear in this world. And that is very, very good news. And the book of Kings leaves us as people, you know, with an honest assessment of the kingdoms of this world, but with a faint glimmer of hope that there's another kind of power that can break in. And we who follow Jesus can read backwards into this text as this story ends waiting for a sequel, and the sequel has come, and it's been Jesus and his work in this world. Now, unfortunately, that's all we'll have time for with 1 and 2 Kings. I hope you will read through them in their entirety. They're rich, and hope you enjoyed the overview of 1 and 2 Kings.
Praise Father, Son, and